Welcome to Points of Departure, a podcast from the Arkansas Global Changemakers in coordination with KUAF Public Radio,
where we aim to place pressing social issues into global context
and bring communities together to find local solutions to global challenges.
My name is Lawrence Hare, Associate Professor of History in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences.
And I am Rogelio Garcia Contreras, Teaching Assistant Faculty in the Walden College of Business.
And I'm Daniel Carruth, a producer and reporter for KUAF Public Radio. And we're your hosts for Points of Departure.
Welcome to a new episode and a new season of Points of Departure. My name's Lawrence Hare, and joining me as always is my colleague Rogelio Garcia Contreras. Rogelio, how are you?
Very good, Lawrence, and you?
I'm great. So this good. Is our 4th season of Points
Indeed.
Of Departure.
Incredible.
And we always talk about whether we want to do a theme for the season, and we have decided that we want to focus on local, national, and international issues related to sustainable development. Now, Rogelio, you're teaching a course right now on international development at the University of Arkansas. How's that going? I haven't heard.
I have enjoyed the course very much. You know, I was preparing the syllabus and I was thinking, I need to take this course. You know, this is so exciting. This is fascinating. And, I hope the students are thinking the same thing. I mean, I think they are enjoying it. There's lots of participation and lots of theories that we look at. And, you know, we're just enjoying ourselves.
Oh, that's terrific. So, as you know, development has a history. I'm a historian, so I'm always wanting to talk about history. And development has a history. And over time, the way that we think about development has changed. So I thought I would just say a couple of words about this. And this is a little history lesson. I won't charge you for it. It's totally free.
Good.
You can give the money to the KUAF radio station instead.
For sure.
Here you go. So if we want to talk about what development is, one way that I might think about it is as a process of building capacity for economic activity. Now this means lots of things. This means harnessing resources, farming, fishing, mining, etc., converting fuels into energy, recruiting and training a workforce, establishing trading networks, safeguarding markets, establishing currencies, raising capital, et cetera, et cetera. If we want to go way back to the beginning, to the 18th century, international development has always gone hand in hand with the emergence of capitalism and the expansion of Western imperialism. As industrial economies emerged, powers in Europe and later even the United States used overseas connections and foreign colonies to create secure economic networks, gain access to resources, transport goods to markets at home, and create consumer markets abroad. The process involved, of course, episodes of coercion and violence. It was connected to the transatlantic slave trade, later to efforts to force colonial subjects into wage-earning labor oriented towards European markets. In the U.S., it accelerated Western expansion, the removal of Native American peoples, and it brought colonial powers into conflict in contested zones abroad. So it has a checkered past.
No, I think what you're mentioning here is very important, you know, that constant association of the notion of development with the premises that colonialism and later Western imperialism established around the world, you know, and our notion of development in general, how it has shaped by those factors. And then, you know, after World War II, this really materialized.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing is that after the Second World War, the image of development became one as a process that could actually promote cooperation between world powers and could ensure peace. Even as the war was raging in 1944, the Allied powers signed the Bretton Woods Agreement, mm-hmm. which created a mechanism for stabilizing world currencies and launched future rounds of trade negotiations that lowered tariffs and integrated much of the world in a global economic network. In this context, economic development became part of a push for decolonization and for capital investments to bring countries in the global South into the world economy. But here, too, there were false assumptions and unintended effects. Theorists of development promoted the idea that countries progress in stages towards an advanced stage of economic activity. And these countries intervened in the affairs of former colonies in the belief that they could transform into the image of existing advanced economies, in the image of the European countries and the United States.
And not only that, but there was the tendency to associate development with capitalism, development with technological development. So the association of capitalism and technology and even consumption started to give shape to this notion of development.
It's interesting to talk about. I hope your students are getting to think about this because, I mean, on the one hand, this is the idea that these types of investments raise all boats, right? I mean, but on the other hand, there tended to be this one-size-fits-all approach that was not always right for all places. And so that brings us closer to our own day. The late 20th century, a number of economists, including economists from the Global South, and one that you've mentioned to your class is Amartya Sen, who is a South Asian scholar who writes about development as a mechanism for freedom.
Nobel Prize winner, yes, indeed. And he has a very interesting association. You know, he defines development as freedom, and then freedom as the sine qua non for justice, right? And it was, yeah. So he establishes these five principles of freedom, right? A man without political freedom, without economic freedom, without social freedom, without the security of their governments, you know, to flourish and expand their innovation and their creativity, without the transparency that is needed in the political system, these individuals are unable to achieve development, right? So it's like a much more comprehensive version of development as opposed of the what was happening right after World War II, and especially during the 1960s and 70s, where there is this recipe and this association between development and democracy, development and capitalism, development and technology.
Right.
And this is much more of a comprehensive perspective of development that these perspectives from the Global South start introducing.
Yeah, and this is where we get the idea of sustainable development. Right. What do you tell students about sustainable development? How do you explain that to them?
Well, I think it's a new paradigm, right? And it's a new understanding of how development touches on everyone's life at every single dimension of the human experience, right? So it's not only about economic growth. It's not only about technological prosperity. It's not only about accessing infrastructure. It's also about education and the possibilities of education beyond our material world, right? It's about equity, for instance, gender equity and the possibilities that that brings to, for instance, our relationship with one another, but also our relationship with nature, right? And the possibility of imagining a human experience that is prosperous, that is wealthy, but at the same time lives in a way that guarantees that prosperity and that wealth for generations to come.
And at the forefront of all this has been the United Nations. And in many ways, the United Nations has lots of challenges. I mean, global governance is a huge problem in the world. How do we bring countries together to solve common challenges? But one of the places that the United Nations has really taken a meaningful lead has been in the promotion of sustainable development. In 1987, for example, the UN so-called Brundtland Commission put forward a report that was called Our Common Future, which stressed the importance of international cooperation for sustainable development. Then, in the beginning of the 21st century, that's where we live, the UN introduced a set of Millennium Development Goals, which were 8 objectives that blended calls for environmental sustainability with social objectives like reducing child mortality and promoting gender equality. Then, in 2015, they introduced a new slate of goals called the Sustainable Development Goals, or the SDGs. And you'll hear us talk a lot about the SDGs, and our guests will mention those. The number of objectives in the SDGs increased from 8 to 17 and included a more specific set of goals, including responsible consumption and production and sustainable cities and communities.
And that is fascinating. And it's not, you know, 17 goals, but each of these goals have numerous action items. And one thing that is interesting about the Sustainable Development Goals is how they are all interconnected. And you cannot actually achieve one goal without achieving the others, right? So if any of the goals is incomplete, then that means that all of the goals are incomplete. So it's a very comprehensive approach, and it's a very ambitious goal that the United Nations has set for the world, because this is what is known as well as the 2030 agenda, which you'll hear our guests refer to as well. And this is just the idea that, you know, most of these goals, well, all of these goals must be achieved by the year 2030. It's 2024.
Time's running out.
It's running out. It doesn't look like we're going to be able to do it, but perhaps we should question pursuing or going after these goals with such a timeline refers to the urgency of the situation, right? Like how desperately bad we need these goals to materialize. But at the same time, making progress is perhaps much more important than actually materializing.
Well, I actually talked to a representative to the UN. One of the Belgian representatives came on campus a few weeks ago, and we had a chance to ask him that very question. His name was Carl Agati. And we said, well, you've set these really lofty goals that it seems unlikely that we're going to meet by 2030. Like, how do you feel about that? Do you feel disappointed about the lack of progress or the potential that we may not reach these objectives? And he had a very optimistic response. He said, look, we have to set these goals in the most ambitious way possible. Mm-hmm. We have to encourage people to strive and do their best to try to meet them. And even if we don't completely reach the objectives that we set, making progress is its own reward.
This is shared by at least one of our guests in the season, Toshiro Nakamura, who mentions precisely that, right? The idea that it's going to be very difficult to fulfill these goals, but the art is in the process.
Yes, right. Yeah. Well, and here's the other thing. So the UN can set the goals. They can create the frameworks. They can show how the objectives are linked. But really, at the end of the day, it is up to the member nations. It is up to the non-governmental organization sector. It is up to the public sector. And it is up to individuals like us to actually make the goals work. Right. And as we're discussing in this season, it is also the responsibility of the business community, of corporations and even small businesses. And these businesses, whose purpose has traditionally been to earn a profit, are increasingly looking for ways to procure resources, develop supply chains, produce goods and services, transport them to market, and sell them in ways that are more responsible and more sustainable. And the question for many of our guests is, how can they achieve this expanded mission while staying true to their mission as a for-profit industry?
That is the question indeed.
So Rogelio and I recently had a chance to discuss this with Martin Wolf. A chemist by training, Wolf works with companies to manufacture sustainable products. He founded a company of his own known as Seventh Generation, which derives its name from an Iroquois saying that claims every decision must take into account its impact on seven generations. Wolf makes the rounds on the speaking circuit, promoting the notion that we have to put planet above people, respect the cycles of nature, and he maintains that businesses must work in the service of humanity. As you will hear, the conversation took some interesting turns as we hear a business insider's perspective on the prospects of sustainable development as a goal of industry in the corporate sector.
And I just want to bring the attention of our audience to the fact that he's the director of sustainability and authenticity at Seventh Generation. So that word authenticity is really interesting.
You're listening to Points of Departure. That conversation with Martin Wolf is coming up after this break.
Hi, my name is Nacho Dean. I'm a naturalist, a professional explorer. I'm currently living in Spain, and I listen to Points of Departure.
Every day, Ozarks at Large brings you the news, music, and culture that make our corner of the world unique. You can hear live music performed inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio, sit in on conversations with community leaders, and hear reported stories about immigrant communities, the environment, and politics. Listen weekdays on 91.3 KUAF or search for Ozarks at Large in your podcast app.
So welcome to another edition of Points of Departure. We are here this morning at the KUAF studios. Thank you, Mr. Wolf, for being here with us today. And I would like to start the conversation by asking you to tell us a little bit about your interest in general about this topic. What does sustainability mean to you?
That's a very broad question, and thank you for that introduction. You know, sustainability to me means living not just our individual lives, but also our community lives in a way that can be continued into the future indefinitely. And to use the Brundtland Commission definition, the Brundtland Commission is the United Nations Sustainable Development Commission definition of sustainability, which is to meet our needs today without diminishing the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And obviously, that means we have to use the resources that are available to us on this wonderful planet and make sure that they're available to our children, grandchildren, and generations beyond. So that means we can't squander them. We can't just bury them in landfills. We can't simply destroy them. And it also means that we have to recognize that we need to be living in harmony with the systems on Earth that create sustainability, that it's not people that create sustainability, but the Earth has been here for over 4.5 billion years, and we are just part of its evolution. And the systems that created the first one-celled animals or the first amphibious creatures or the first dinosaurs, the first mammals, and ultimately us, is a system that is not only sustainable, but evolves to improve over time. I mean, to be part of that system and not harm it.
That, to me, is fantastic, the concept of harmony and the relationship that we have with nature, not as these entities that control or exploit the resources available, but as part of nature itself, being subject to these laws of nature, right, in a way. And this reminds me of the work of one of our previous guests, Dr. Rianne Eisler, who advocates for the transition from an economy of exploitation and control to an economy of collaboration and partnership, right? What does that mean to you as a corporate executive? You know, how do you bring that concept of harmony into the corporate world?
I think that's a wonderful framing to look at it as cooperation, not only with nature, but also with each other, rather than just a competition. The way I look at it from a corporate standpoint is to look somewhat beyond the so-called triple bottom line of people, planet, and profit, and to consider, for example, that if we are not living in a healthy environment, then we as people cannot be healthy. So we need to preserve the environment first, because it is what embraces and sustains all of us. And then we, as a hopefully harmonious civilization, though we don't see a lot of that harmony right now in the world, but if we can bring ourselves to somehow get beyond the tribalism and conflicts of today to create a more harmonious civilization, then we have to recognize that commerce is needed between people to sustain that civilization. And it needs to be a commerce of equality, because as you create inequality, you create forces that will try to disrupt the system.
So it's very interesting that you bring up the triple bottom line. You started the conversation with the Brundtland Commission, which is 1987. And so clearly the triple bottom line has come along as thinking about sustainability has grown. And if you're not familiar with the concept of the triple bottom line, essentially it promotes an idea of return on investment that includes a financial return, a social return, and an environmental return. And you have been a critic of the idea of the triple bottom line, as you just described. And you're not the only one. Some others have come along and have suggested, for example, that the idea of the triple bottom line may be somewhat flawed because you can't fundamentally meet these three goals without a change in the system. And I wanted to ask you whether, well, first let me quote two things I've heard you say in other contexts. One, we have to put planet above people. That's part of your take on the triple bottom line. And two, business must be in the service of humanity, which is what you've said here. I'm wondering if you think that your critique of the triple bottom line similarly extends to a critique of the system as a whole, or does it implicate systemic change?
We definitely need systemic change to evolve from where we are today, which, to use the quote of Professor Contreras, is an exploitive approach to commerce. And that means we need to define or redefine the objectives of commerce. Right now, the objective is primarily to reward shareholders. That is actually written into law, as most jurisdictions have articles of incorporation that demand a board of directors of a company that holds a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders of that company, not to the stakeholders generally. So we have a system, understandable given how in the 1929 crash there was exploitation of shareholders, understandable, but obviously not sufficient to create a truly sustainable and equitable commerce. So we need to change that fundamental premise of how commerce is conducted. The second thing we have to do is recognize that, contrary to the Chicago School of Economics, greed is not good. Greed leads to inequalities and abuses and exploitation to benefit a few at the expense not only of others, and typically a large number of others, but also at the expense of the environment, which then, in a negative feedback loop, adversely impacts us all. There was a wonderful New Yorker cartoon, I'm not sure what year it was, but it was years ago, that showed some people sitting around a campfire with a dystopian view of a city in the background. And the speaker is saying, we may have destroyed the environment, but for a few years, we had really high returns on our investments. While I think that's a bit extreme, the point is well made, that we can't think just about our return on investment today, but we have to think about continuing returns on future investments.
There are so many thoughts that cross my mind now with everything that you have been saying and the quotes that Lawrence brought from you in different forums. This reminds me of an economist, Manfred Max Neef, who actually studied at Chicago, was a professor at Berkeley, and then he ended his career at Universidad Austral in Chile. He was a dean there for a while, an economist that would have these principles on economics, and one of them would be human beings are not to serve the economy is to serve human beings. And the other one is that no economic model is possible in a without a functional ecosystem, right? A fair, sustainable ecosystem, right? So yes, in a way, the idea of putting the planet before human beings and understanding what the role of human beings are in this planet appeal to the idea that we cannot exist if the delicate balance of that ecosystem is not present, right? So we depend on this. And to me, this leads me to one big question. Should we make, in this effort of those that believe in the need of a systemic change, the question is, should we make the planet, Mother Earth, a shareholder of our economic activities, a shareholder of our companies? Can you comment on this? What is your opinion about making Mother Earth a shareholder of our economic activities?
So making Mother Earth a shareholder says that the system of commerce and business encompasses the environment.
Yes.
Which is backwards.
Okay.
It's the environment that encompasses our system of business.
Excellent.
I love it. The business has to be seen as a stakeholder in the broader environment.
This is Points of Departure. Still ahead, Wolf explains the current state of climate action and if he's at all optimistic about our future. That's coming up in just a minute on Points of Departure.
This month's Short Talks from the Hill features Daniel Kenefick, professor of physics and a researcher at the Arkansas Center for Space and Planetary Sciences. Kenefick explains the science and history of eclipses. Kenefick also addresses how rare it is that two solar eclipses have crossed the heart of the country in the past 7 years.
We are very fortunate, even if there were people on the other planets of our solar system, this is something that they would not be able to experience. And furthermore, it's not something that will last forever. The moon, as we now know from the Apollo astronauts' work, is slowly drawing away from us. So eventually, it will actually get so far away that it will no longer be large enough in our sky.
You can listen to Daniel Kenefick wherever you get your podcasts or by going to arkansasresearch.uark.edu, the home of research and economic development news at the University of Arkansas.
Back to the triple bottom line, I mean, I've seen you talk about examples. I'm a historian, so I'm very interested in the historical examples I've seen you discuss that are sort of regional or local examples where you can see in the past exploitation unfold and then see dreadful consequences for local or regional ecologies. And I'm wondering if you have ever seen or heard of local or regional examples where the opposite is true, where a region or a community or a business sector may be doing things right or setting a positive example.
So I think there are many indigenous peoples that have a view of their civilization or their society as being derived from what they call Mother Earth. And they're having a high regard for that Mother Earth. And those civilizations have tended to last thousands of years. So in the United States, you know, most of the indigenous peoples in Australia, many of the indigenous peoples in South and Central America, in Mexico, the various tribes all thrived for thousands of years until European thinking was brought to those areas. They were not perfect, and I don't wish to imply that they were perfect. There's evidence of destruction of ecosystems or transformation of ecosystems, but still, for the most part, they had a respect for Mother Earth that we don't have today, that I think is central. You know, having respect first is central to wanting to work with and nurture rather than exploit another entity, be it another being or being it our environment.
Based on what you're saying now, I want to go back to this idea of modern nature becoming a shareholder and you saying that that's backwards. But with what you're saying and the realities of the world today, you know, in the kind of market economy that we coexist and the principles that rule in this economy, how do you see the adoption of a different approach to our relationship to nature, if not through businesses? Businesses constitute, like, I don't know, like a huge percentage. I don't have the data right here with me right now, but a huge percentage of the gross domestic product of the world, right? How else can we break the parameters, the framework under which we operate, so we start making that shift and prioritizing nature over businesses when businesses seem to have the control?
So clearly the current system is not working. It is building wealth for a few individuals rather than having it more equitably distributed. And it's doing it at tremendous expense to our environment and therefore to our well-being. And even our future existence can be viewed as being in doubt. There was a wonderful documentary by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation called The Corporation, which looked at how corporations evolved from being chartered by typically royalty to accomplish certain goals to today's corporations, who have these very broad charters and do whatever they can to reward shareholders rather than meet a very limited and defined objective. Well, we have in place the mechanism to control corporations, and that could require them to meet certain objectives rather than simply to license them to exploit as much as they can to make money to produce wealth for a limited number of shareholders. As I said before, jurisdictions require incorporation of businesses, and that requirement right now is very loose and just requires a fiduciary responsibility to shareholders. What if that requirement also included a maintenance of a certain level of equity between shareholders, employees, and the communities in which the business operated? What if that charter included a mandate not to exploit the earth, but to make sure that any agricultural or mining or other extraction of resources from the earth was repaired or regenerated in some way? What if, instead of viewing lobbying as free speech, we recognized it for what it was, commercial speech, and we limited it so that it didn't interfere with or control our politics? There's so much we could do within the frameworks that we've created, which we've allowed to grow out of control because there are a few people who really want to be wealthy, and they've exploited the weaknesses in these systems. But what if we instead took back these systems so that corporations were in service, if not to the monarch, to our society more generally, to our states and to our country? What if, instead of enriching just shareholders, there was a greater balance between reward to employees and shareholders and communities? What if the contributions or the desire to make contributions to enrich politicians was controlled as commercial speech rather than allowed to run rampant as free speech, with hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, becoming the legal way companies can corrupt our political system?
So I think, I think you're preaching to the choir here. I think we're in agreement with you. I think as well that in every single one of these examples that you have provided, these what ifs, you are also letting us see the different perspectives or dimensions of the sustainability, what we understand or should understand by sustainability, what makes something truly sustainable and a human activity truly sustainable. And it sounds to me that a lot has to do, yes, with money, but also political power. And I wonder how you are, after all, the director of sustainability and authenticity for a major company in America, right?
Working with other major companies.
Yeah, and which is a part of a huge corporation, right? Sometimes we believe that, you know, the same person that has this train of thought and agrees with all these what ifs, you know, pose these questions, you know, like what if we do all these changes, cannot be the same person that is working for a corporation, right? What is the link there? And do you agree that aside from changing the economic structure or system that we have, do we also need this political will, political intention to change things from a different level, you know, the legal, the legislative level?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. We've seen the corruption of our political system, not just in America, but worldwide. Look at Dubai in COP28 right now.
What a story.
We're seeing the very oil companies that we're trying to control having free access, You know, I think they should be there. I think they are shareholders in what needs to be done. But it needs to be done in a way that creates an equivalence of all voices, not the wealthiest having the loudest voices.
Well, they were running. They were presiding over the the whole thing and using it as a platform for their own agenda.
And we see this not just in COP. We see this in the regulations that are put forth by the Environmental Protection Agency here in the U.S. We see it in Great Britain with their rollback of protections. You know, one of the reasons they left the EU was to get out from under the thumb of stricter environmental protections, and they now have highly polluted beaches and rivers because the water authorities have essentially, how can I say this, that they don't see any obligation to purify sewage and just are dumping it. Business applies a lot of pressure to government to end regulation so they can make more profit. But the regulation is needed to make sure that these companies don't create more harm than the wealth they're creating. Unfortunately, we've lost that balance.
To me, you're a great example of how that will is possible, right, in the corporate world. Because at the end of the day, corporations are made out of men and women, like you and I, right? And the ethical framework and emotional intelligence of these men and women are the ones that are making the decisions. And in to some extent, you as an executive for this company, you are, with your day-to-day, with your decisions, making a different kind of corporation, right? That could potentially lead to a different reality that we all agree with all these what ifs, but that is possible, but it's not yet tangible. So would you agree that it is up to us? You know, it is up to us from our different places of engagement, I guess.
I think right now it is up to companies to create or to acknowledge those values and to try to operate in a way that promotes the values that we've discussed. But it's voluntary. And when push comes to shove, when a shareholder from a highly profitable company says, you're not profitable enough, you have to create more profit, we see executives turn to lower cost supply chains, more exploitation of individuals in their value chain, more exploitation of the earth to get their costs down so that they can return more of the investment to the shareholders. It's a broken model. We see that it doesn't work. So to get back to the question you asked earlier, we need a systemic change in the way corporations are chartered and how they are run and the consequences for not running them in a more sustainable way, because by not putting those controls in place, we're allowing corporations to enrich the few at the expense of the many, and ultimately to harm us all as the environment degrades. I'm not an historian, and so Lawrence, you're going to have to be the one who uses the examples from history and correct me when my history is wrong. But what I see as a chemist is a pattern of harms that needs to be corrected, but I'm not seeing the change.
Well, I am seeing awareness, but I'm not seeing incentives growing. And I'm wondering what you think about that, about how you have talked in other venues about natural cycles, about sort of aligning the economy to these natural cycles that are less exploitative. And I'm wondering how you incentivize those kinds of things. If you can't change the whole system overnight, isn't it worthwhile to try to promote good behavior? And if so, how do you do that?
That's a question that I think we're all trying to answer. Another great example comes back to looking at the petrochemical industry. And we know the petrochemical industry gets something in the order of $1.5 trillion in subsidies every year, whereas we struggle to provide subsidies to the electric vehicle market or to the solar market. market, and those that have the money fight to keep it. They fight those regulations, they fight those subsidies, they fight taxes on carbon that could be put to use reducing the impacts of those carbon, because their objective is singularly to provide a fiduciary return or a financial return to their investors. That's their major concern. And we've heard the many petrochemical companies talk about the need to change. But when push comes to shove, we don't see the change actually occurring, because money is a very powerful motivator. And
yeah.
We're not doing anything to change the flow of that money.
And well, sometimes I think that even if very well-intentioned people in that industry see what needs to be done and they see that change needs to happen, I wonder to what extent they may feel sort of trapped in that model themselves, that they can't make that change. You know, I was thinking about, since we were talking about COP28, and COP28 there was a lot of gloom and doom. I mean, there was outright denial of the science of climate change and the connection to fossil fuels. There was a covert effort to promote fossil fuel deals that were in contravention to the goals of COP28. But I don't know if you agree, but one maybe silver lining is that the debate over the wording of the statements coming out of COP28 was the difference between phasing out fossil fuels and phasing down fossil fuels. And of course, phasing down fossil fuels is much less impactful than phasing out fossil fuels. But I wonder if there's at least some recognition that something has to happen and something has to change, and it's not possible to completely forestall that shift.
I think that recognition is there, but can it happen fast enough with so many forces aligned against the change, against rapid change? 30 or 40 years ago, when we first started talking about climate change, we could have introduced changes that were gradual, that would have allowed industry to adjust over time. But those changes were fought. And we find ourselves now with much less time in which to make those very rapid changes. And that makes it even more difficult.
You know, this last point takes me back to your point on greed and about the need of bringing balance into our business practices. You know, the same kind of balance and equilibrium that we see in nature, right? Even if delicate, it's very difficult to achieve. So maybe a question to kind of wrap up our conversation is related to, how optimistic are you based on the experience that you have working for this major company in the U.S.? How optimistic are you of our ability to find this balance soon enough? You keep referring to how soon we can arrive to the model that we need in order to be sustainable in this planet. So how optimistic are you that we're going to be able to do it?
So I'm sure you both are aware that scientists have defined what they call global boundaries, thresholds in various aspects of the environment, which if crossed, it's believed will create irreversible changes. We are perilously close to, I think, 5 of those boundaries at this point. Climate change due to global warming being one of the most severe, biodiversity being another, toxics in the environment, including plastic pollution, yet another. So we have to act quickly, or there's going to be drastic change to the environment that will lead to thousands, if not millions, of deaths of people, loss of species around the globe. Will that signal the end to life on Earth? No. Life is amazingly resilient. I love to go hiking and see these magnificent rock structures, and growing on the top 3 or 4 inches of soil on a rock, these 20 and 30 and 40 foot trees. You know, you wonder how anything can grow there, but life just seems to find a way. So I am optimistic that life on this planet will continue, including human life, if we are not cautious, if we don't start to reverse some of the trends that we have set in motion, we are going to create tremendous hardship for many generations to come. And they will have to adjust to a very different climate, to a very different world than the one that has allowed us to evolve and grow and create the wealth we've created. In a sense, I'm optimistic, but in a sense, I'm also pessimistic that we're going to do things the hard way.
It does seem that as a species, we're better at being reactive than proactive, unfortunately. But there's always a chance.
Absolutely.
There's always a chance. Martin Wolf, Director of Sustainability and Authenticity at Seventh Generation Incorporated, thank you so much for joining us today on Points of Departure.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Points of Departure. Your hosts are Rogelio Garcia Contreras and Lawrence Hare. I'm Daniel Carruth. Points of Departure is a podcast production of KUAF Public Radio and Arkansas Global Changemakers. And to learn more about topics discussed in this episode, links and information about our guests, as well as the previous episodes, you can find that all at our website, kuaf.com.